corresponding industry requirements all in fact intensified. There was a yeah, a suspicion of that. We're now
applying us.
Possibly it was very intended, So it's just what the team requires. And then set out some evidence of Mr. Ferguson. Chapter 6 provisions are in the state of flux at the moment. Council for the council confirms that the assessment measures for O&Ls do not apply to the checkpoint zone. And I think the only ambiguity is the direct application of O&L specific checklist and design. That still seems to be in the state of flux in terms of the notified version compared to the flight of flight from the council and what service in the store. So, you know, just key warnings to be taken and then just follow through logically the implication of what policies are directly relevant and what aren't when you do the overall evaluation. But in any event, whether this is an O&L in the course of the plan and specific policies apply, or whether you are applying section 16, because it is an O&L, on the merits and on the way to the evidence, our submissions are that we've attended before you go to the check those O&L values and the development that's provided for is appropriate. We simply look at it on the merits. In terms of access into improved zones, critical to the optimal layout of the zone is access. And as noted by Chapter 41, only if there's two access points off the state highway, and there was a difference of opinion at that point as to when the second access from Walshed Road should be required. So, and the submitters have reflected on the subsequent evidence from EPCA and Scope Resources in particular, received on 3 February and agreed that provisions need to provide certainty on the mechanism that will ensure access to the zone is upgraded to required. All parties agree that Walshed Road is an appropriate access for the zone, subject to an appropriate upgrade of the intersection of the state highway. As a primary road access through the zone to its centre, it will eventually fulfil an important primary road function to the internal layout of the zone and third access and resilience to transport to and from and through the zone. There is sure of whether or not there needs to be an immediate trigger that requires the upgrade and subsequent use of the road now being superseded by the consenting of the additional access off the state highway to service the proposed subdivision. The question of when Walshed Road should be upgraded in the medium term so that it can be used for general access into the zone when the scale of traffic movement requires the community justifier can be addressed by ensuring that the appropriate rules reserve and their discretional control effect on the safety and efficiency of the state highway network and the intersection of the checkpoint zone. So at a point in time that is apparent Walshed Road is required, council has the requisite ability to do so. The submitters therefore propose a set of provisions reserving the control of discretion be added to the following activity rules, and this is there in more detail in the Ferguson Supplementary explained for them. In its design, we've targeted the rules that are rules that are likely for activities that are likely to contribute to vehicle movement out by the zone, to and from the zone.
Why not the
because the village is designed to keep movements internal or to service the needs of the residents, so it reduces the requirement for residents to meet the zone. So it's very
good.
The zone as notified only has the one access, which was the main access into the village. So the assumption that the village has always been an is a meat producer of the external trade of the fish, the fact for which when we look at the village, it's not falling into that category. It's location relative to Washington Road and Arrowjack Road and the history that's gone behind living in the village. And the village in terms of the seasons are the reasons why it wasn't considered appropriate to include it in that camp.
So why is the military accommodation provided for? The visitors don't need to go on what I do, do they?
No, because the village will serve most of the needs here of the visitors, it's not external in terms of large restaurants.
So that comes from somewhere.
Oh, that comes from somewhere.
And then they go somewhere.
Yes.
And presumably, while Jack's point has several attractions, one of the sole reason coming to Princeton, what if they stay there and go skiing every day? Won't that create some traffic?
Yeah, there will be traffic associated with that.
But shouldn't that be wanted?
At the point of convenience.
I mean, it just seems to me that the green sector on the residential area, and yes, education and daycare activities, well, those certainly are largely going to have a lot of things, people within the within the actual area.
Although, if there's a tertiary institution that pops up,
An intersection is established at Wolfshead Road, the state highway. The layout of the place is such, given that it's already modelled with the vast majority of traffic will come from the Queenstown direction rather than the Cable direction, Wolfshead Road is a vastly more attractive way of getting into the zone than the Jacks Point Road will be. Because I can't see anybody using Jacks Point Road at all unless you're going to the Cable or you're one of those Jacks Point pods that's very close to the main highway. The Woolshed Road has a huge attraction, you know, not at least 2 days of it. Whether you're going to Woolshed East or Homestead Bay, if I was going from Queenstown to Homestead Bay, that's the route I would follow.
Well, the flip side of that is you can travel further on Woolshed Road if you're going to the village through Woolshed Bay than if you come down Mount Jack Road. So if you're going to rather than going through the 50k zone or longer,
take me
directly
out to people take the first thing
off they see. I was wondering, in terms of how the trigger works here on under your 92, does that mean if someone applied to establish one of these activities, that immediately means that somebody has to apply for the essentially upgrade?
No, words and the rules. It becomes a matter of controllable discretion that the applicant has to evaluate. And if on that evaluation it becomes necessary that we should write an upgrade, then that is provided for in a check provision that says Woolshed Road can only be used to access the zone once it is an upgrade in the course of the NPCA's requirements. If it's not, the NPCA haven't approved the upgrade, and then the new uses, then that triggers a strict discretionary system. where the street was restricted to and make the pavement efficient functioning of the highway very easily. So kind of a sequence.
Would that fail for third parties here?
Well, I don't think that the case does, because whether or not that was actually written into the rule, the NDCA approval, I think that is required anyway, such as the NDCA separate secretary out. So it's really that to make it very clear that this is required anyway for that level of use of traffic on that road to get access to South Bay Highway. So Ms. McColl will probably be the person to answer about that, but I respect on the understanding that we are just writing in that rule what is it that they take back, such as specific statutes, so I'm sure that that was under any misunderstanding. And then if that process has not been gone through that separate statutory process, there's a restricted discretion activity to make zone traffic to lead on the watershed roads and exit that highway. Mr. McColl, hopefully that's how this
turns out. Yes, it's one follow-up.
And then I have further at 93, in any event, attempted to or if we go back to the trigger context, which everyone is happy to move on from, attempted to model a particular trigger or specify a particular scale of upgrade did not hold a systems contributor to the evidence or scope resources. On review of a separate submission from scope resources, they seek to rezone land on the opposite side of the state highway just north of Bullshit Road for an industrial B zone. And it's apparent that it would not be appropriate, sensible, or at all helpful to normally set triggers in isolation of what may or may not be the future use of the adjacent scope resource streams. And I attached one of the appendices to that submission showing the intent of the site proposed for renaming to industrial B. A trigger for an access for Bullshit Road is meaningless without a more comprehensive understanding of what the uses of the land on the other side of the state highway. And until that time, presuming in the matter of discretion, steps on the safety and efficiency of the state highway that then work with any intersection with Jack's Point Zone to an appropriate set of activities to generate traffic movement often on the state highway, ensure that the need for opening up Bullshit Road can be addressed at the appropriate time in the future. Just conscious, I don't want to feel that you're just in the lead, and if I want to start skipping through some parts and getting onto the witch box. I've got more important things to say tonight. So, I have set out some submissions on the relevant provisions of the new use of legal governments.
I do have my questions today.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we do have a more holistic opportunity to lodge submissions on the relevance of the end use in development, is that correct, in early March?
Depending on the council approach.
Right, depending on the council approach.
Maybe the submissions is the best time to deal
with. Right, yeah. So I just wonder if it's not necessary exactly for us to go into that detail today.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's okay. And similarly, you and I touched on the NPS on freshwater management, where I set out to you what I consider to be the relevant provisions that Cambridge Land is required to give effect to, including district plans on page 24. And some relevant case law from the Environment Court and Mount Kamarunu Kiwi Authority and Hawke's Bay Regional Council, confirming that those higher order objectives about protecting water quality and ensuring that there is no degradation, that they are a very firm requirement. So if it is considered helpful to have a policy that requires that with respect to Lake Tiwa and the wetlands, then that was consistent in effect to those higher order provisions. And the final section of my submission addressed the scope of the needed relief. Do you want me to go through those in detail, or is that a matter that is at least to your final answer at later points?
think we could probably go for some of that a little more.
Yes,
because that's be on the same ballpark. Yes, I think we need to deal with some of the spectrum of methods.
Yes.
I think that's very simple.
Yeah, so first of all, scope for the change to the what was notified as the EP1 area. And notified for EP1 area provided for residential visitor accommodation, farming, farm workers, trails, recreation, mining and controls, and the density working for a rural lifestyle type of development up to 34 lands. In 4,000 square, minimum notified and average of 30 years. And this has been replaced by the identification of only 20 carefully identified and located homes or areas with dwellings which program is permitted, but as I flagged, we have to accept council's position on controls for that. This approach relies on individual sites being selected for residential development based on the suitability of self-development and minimizing additional effects. The open space goals are now proposed around the balance of the previous EC1 area, which will provide for the creation and management of open space in which mainstream native vegetation within open space areas. Open space goals is notified provides for golf courses, including earthworks, groundkeeping, driving range, administrative offices, mining, sales and commercial instruction. Buildings for administrative offices associated with golf courses are permitted subject to an annual height standard and subdivision of historic services. There are no specific submission number OSG structure planning activities. And this new layout reduces the opportunity for fragmentation of the tableland overlay through rural living development being as clear as going through EP1 and notified. So in summary, the expected changes from the PEP are as follows. EP1 provides for farm building and controls and visitor accommodation is strict discretionary. Residential activity on sites created in accordance with the relevant subdivision rule was permitted, whereas not in accordance with the other subdivision rule was strict discretionary. Subdivision control activity was no minimum block site and up to 34 dwellings. Now as proposed, buildings and home sites are to be changed as controlled, subject to standards of 5 metre height and not to exceed a total building footprint of 1,000 square metres. Outside of the home site, subdivision is still controlled, however, activities not to residential visitor accommodation are only 20 proposed sites now identified. So these proposed amendments provide more certainty as to the locations of buildings, and they provide for a reduced number of residential sites, reducing the scale of activity and built form compared to that as notified. Given that a number of submitters opposed the notified zoning on EC1 completely, predominantly on the basis of rezoning previous open space, there is scope for that particularly reduction in the scale of activity.
Just one question. The OSG subdivision posing control activity with no minimum and lot size. I think the most questions on that is the scope to change that cycle and notify as discretionary.
Which
notify as
discretionary?
Subdivision.
Subdivision in the OSG. Subdivision in the
EP1. Notified but it actually specified. It says that fails to comply as discretionary.
Right, yeah, that's the trick. Well, that might be something that the first person can verify and do like.
Yes, and if just seeing your submission that you want to minimize or the one of the benefits is that the open space golf is not broken up, then why are we being asked to allow the subdivision with no minimum lot size of the control activity?
So,
like, yeah,
same question as this morning, which we will try and
address. I take it what you're trying to address with this particular point up to paragraph 125 is the fact that somebody out there might have said, well, I know you're going to move the power plant 53, I would have submitted this, that that's the kind of thing you're trying to get off there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is, there was only 34 houses in India over if you want to get notified. So now that there's certainty about where they are, the effect was assessed. In brief, key two, now proposed to be two home sites. Previously, the key two activity area provided for a strict discretionary development within two contained areas of land. It is now being replaced by careful finding of proposed home sites 57 and 58 in an area surrounded by open OSL. The only OSL of each home site remains the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area overlay. In addition, great certainty is provided regarding the landscape outcomes for the visually sensitive parts of the OSL compared to the PEC that are notified. To ensure the visually sensitive parts of the OSL are adequately protected, status of status of building developments, with the exception of farm buildings and recreation buildings. Within the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area, we now propose to non-comply with either the previous discretionary. Additionally, the policy framework relating to this area has been strengthened to provide for a more robust protection of landscape values. Summary is notified any residential units in the research in the area, any litter accommodation with discretionary, any building with PHLP with discretionary, farm buildings with controls, and the density requirements were 2 hectares minimum lot drivers and an average of 40 hectares. Now, the proposed residential litter accommodation is limited to 2 home sites identified, and the surrounding OSL provides landscape protection and provision that largely retained is notified by the Green Commission. There is need to fill in infrastructure and reflect through the means to the dwellings. Buildings in the home site will still be restricted discretionary. The building limits to 5 metre height, where the 1,000 metre square limitation is now removed, but offset by restriction and careful sighting of the home site. As the 51 independent is an outcome of my submission, it is more certain and has reduced the sense of nature and scale of activity and effect that the PDP has notified. And the combined submission in opposition. For the EIC, now residential activity area, the EIC is replaced with HDPH3 and the commercial retail education aspect of the EIC moves into the village. As notified, the EIC provided for technology based activities, including commercial rental, research, laboratories, training, educational facilities, specialist healthcare and associated administrative office accommodation, retail and recreation. The size of individual commercial activities has no restriction and retail is capped at 200 square meters for each tenancy. The new RHDFH3 area narrows the types of activities anticipated from the wider suburbs, primarily residential. The residential density proposed the same level as RHDFH1, 12 to 22 per hectare. And the overall site coverage would be low, not exceeding 30%, compared to that as notified, potentially up to 70%. Building height will be limited to 8 metres for residential buildings compared to the notified, which contemplated commercial activity buildings up to 15 metres. Screen for views is still proposed, but on the northern boundary of the state as notified. It concerns the amendment from the Pluga, now proposed scale of build form within the residential area will be less than originally proposed within the EIC in terms of height and site coverage. And those commissions in support of the EOT are notified to support the provision of education activities and facilities generally in the Jackson site. Those commissions are therefore addressed by ensuring sufficient land in the consolidated village to provide for those activities. Some committees thought reinstatement of the Office of Plan provision, which had no EOT, so a lot of them are holding the head. Relief between the ODT and the PEC is notified for extremely broad and would encompass the reduced nation scale of the RHDFH3 activity area now proposed. Mm-hmm. would be edict to the area and notified now the controller at Jetport Village. It notified that provided for educational safety facilities in the Jetport position sought to expand the scope of the area to also provide health facilities. The now proposed single consolidated village area absorbs the previous fee, provides for these facilities with a broader range of village activities to consolidate and take up the FCS by removing the key load fee. Sorry, maybe I've watched
that. I guess
I've taken a look. Here, 134. The area is located next to the village community of Great Kiwa and residential neighbourhoods. Due to its central location to be well integrated into the central part of Jetport, given its location in proximity to the village core. The amended proposal retains the provision of the activity as notified, but consolidates them into one activity area instead. And this consolidation is a logical inclusion within the existing village and will have no effect in terms of having that character and identity.
I can recall these comments and having pretty large cracks of the
dividend. Yes. I'll skip down to D. Under the village rules now proposed, the anticipated activities compared to EH will include commercial, community, residential, visitor accommodation activities, and associated buildings as control, subject to compliance with a detailed comprehensive development plan. Buildings up to 12 metres high and the total building coverage is 60% over the whole village area. Retail continues to be kept at commission rent 300 per site per activity, and the treatment of commercial activities differs from the EOC, which is no cap, is transferred to the village. Add to that package our acceptance that the cap of 9.9 for commercial and 2.1 for retail can be part of that package and confirm the constraints. The size of the power activities.
Should we also add in there the 2 hectares
of the and the 2 hectares that the comprehensive development plan must ensure is the set size.
Are you able to tell us what the size of the E area was at that time?
Approximately 5 hectares. Collectively, there are no opposing submissions to the specific village and area activity area that is notified, other than the Jetport submission to expand activities that can take place in E, and those oppositions that need to reinstate the area position generally. The broad nature of comprehensive healthcare and education facilities lends itself to the expectation of necessary associated facilities such as community, office, accommodation, etc. These facilities all ensure an integrated working activity area function sustainably. For the purposes of scope, the remaining changes to evaluate are a height increase of 2 metres to the heat area and an increase in overall building coverage. However, the new requirement for a comprehensive development plan for the whole village activity area and the associated change in activity space from committed to controlled, with control retained over several metres that will impact on the scale and layout of buildings, means that there is scope for the proposed expansion of reasonable E when assessed comprehensively. In terms of the scale of the village overall, the officer plan has 2 village areas checked for the end down with a total of 28.95 hectares. On notified DPA, only 1 village, the EIC and the education and health activity areas, a large component of which was a target education property token of 37.042. They're all consolidated into the proposed village area of 26.8, a portion of which is also village education, not commercial retail. This is a decrease from the octave position, and in terms of scope and numbers of the village as a whole, a decrease from the notified position in terms of land rather than commercial retail and community activities.
What we haven't really covered is by not making the E and D, you increase the range of activities potentially available in the E, including high-density residential, retail, and commercial, and I didn't see anywhere in the submission scope to enable that.
Well, that's the how do the requirements for the comprehensive development plan that we're on today, that when you look at the village campus as a whole, and the facial layout and the controls that are put in place for that process, that's where taking that more integrated approach to the village area gives scope for those activities to be spread out through the wider area rather than one section over here, a section of room for another section over there. And in terms of the key of that, that little function is functioning as a whole, and so that's where the effects are on the That's where the effects should not be materially different, because you know, we're also taking into account the consolidation of the EIC down there as well. So it's a complex consolidation, but the impact of it is more concentrated and more efficient, and it's not an intensification when you look at it on the road as a whole.
That might be the case in the application, but when we have a notified provision, we have submissions, and you said there are no submissions in Tokyo. There are no submissions seeking to add additional activities into that area. What scope do we have to change that?
Well, there was a submission seeking to add the health activities.
Well, yes, healthcare, but yeah. Yes, so, but that doesn't cover high density residential, limited accommodation, commercial, retail.
No, retail aspects will help you. Oh, that's the reason, but that's what I mean. When those activities are all can be comprehensively planned for the future of the town as a whole, each activity
I agree that you can do all that, but yeah. I'm concerned about our jurisdiction to actually change the plan provision without any submissions.
Well, it's not a change, it's a
fundamental change.
There's no cap on the visitor accommodation or residential
components
of the village.
There isn't the E. 5 hectares of that land. Well, like 5 hectares of that land. The only scope we have is the inner E, patient services or healthcare services, according to the major submissions before us.
Well, yeah, in terms of scope, and this is the mirror, in terms of scope, we consider that the effects of, the 18.7 notified for village, which could have been a lot of money in residential and visitor accommodation, when you spread that out to the wider area through the comprehensive development and control of, the increase in activity space control of the
commission.
I think there is scope there.
How can you spread it out without a submission?
Because we've changed the activity space. It was previously permitted. Now there is an element of council control over the layout and the what goes there through that wider area. And that's the optimum way to plan a county. Right. Well, I'll see if there's anything I can find to further help you on that point.
We can move on to your conclusion.
My conclusion, so the planned provisions being advanced by Checkpoint are intended to enable a particular vision to be achieved. A vision that Council signed up to in 2003 and through the notification of Chapter 41 continues to support. The provisions are now advanced as a result of vast experience and in-depth knowledge and detail understanding of the site and its ability to absorb change. Chapter 41 started out as a result of working together with Council, and now at this stage of the process, the proposed provisions are the result of further hard work and a formal book of between the submitter and Council experts. The protections of the plan, combined with the non-statutory protections enforced by JPRA and the imposition of restrictive covenants, combined to get those provisions realised. The district plan review should see out the completion of the development of the Jackpoint Zone to the point that the Council of the Development Vision has set out in 2003 is achieved. An exceptional living environment and village community centred around the base of open space, natural and recreation values. So,
yeah.
witness. This was Gabby. Some summary statements here. One of the names you used this morning was the fact that the village at the moment has a contested outline development plan, and that I've got a rising from Preston yesterday about the utility status of the village and whether or not that's appropriate, plan changes and so on. We've got two copies of the improved outline development plan and three documents. We'll make sure that they're all on the public record,
Including hotel visitor
So these mixed-use buildings, mixed-use we mean incorporating a mix of retail, restaurants, office, and residential living, is ensured by a corresponding restriction on surrounding residential activity areas to be limited in accommodating these site uses. This is a very fundamental and critical point. Confirmation of the final 22 preserved home sites, a single consolidated village activity area of approximately 26 hectares, and I refer to that as the canvas, the blank canvas, and provision of 12 hectares of residential in place of what was identified for education innovation campus activity area does remain consistent with the original vision for design and are very important economic outcomes that allow a significant area of approximately 300 hectares, this is a protected important landscape, to be formally dedicated as protected natural agent space on an enduring basis. And this is a key component for the completion of the Jack's Point Master Plan. I support the provisions in the Jack's Point Zone providing for a range of residential options from the higher density living within what is now one central pedestrian-focused village precinct, radiating out to increasingly lower density options on the peripheral areas. It is important that adequate areas of green open space, linked pedestrian cycle networks, and planned parking be provided for as residential density increases. I attach a copy by way of background information of the approved outline development plan for the village. That document illustrates the detailed level of design consideration that will continue to be applied to the village, and I consider that to preserve a robust assessment process. For several reasons, I believe residential density and greenfield development should be set on an activity growth area basis, that is, before you deduct areas required for roading and open space, or have specific open space performance standards that increase the density. I concur with Council's urban design expert that the minimum permitted residential lot size should be 380 square metres. Develop housing on lots below, I refer to a range here of 350 to 400, requires a comprehensive development approach. And in my experience, it does increase development costs significantly and therefore doesn't always deliver or improve home affordability. On this basis, I consider the upper permitted density in one of the activity areas referred to as residential HDP at 45 dwellings per hectare has created considerable confusion and given rise to concerns as to the living quality of those neighbourhoods and their effect on surrounding areas. I consider that a more appropriate relevant range of dwellings per hectare would be between 17 and 24 per hectare, taking into account approximately 35% of land dedicated or required for open space and voting. Additionally, I consider it as of critical importance that visitor accommodation options are sufficiently controlled in residential areas, including in particular the higher density area I just referred to of E. This area should not anticipate visitor accommodation occurring under a lesser activity status than other Jack's Point site residential areas, as this otherwise potentially undermines or compromises the purpose of the village. with its pedestrian centralised focus. In addition to the other matters raised in my evidence, I also wish to address the importance of a linked roading network within the zone. Part of the original vision for the development was to create centralised road corridors which travel through the zone in a way so as to connect and interlink city areas and provide through link with the preserved amenity areas of the zone. The Wolseley Road corridor was designed for this purpose, and it's important that this corridor connection is preserved and that suitable manners of control are included in development provisions to protect the capacity of the intersection and the state highway network. I also attached the summary of a more comprehensive plan showing the land ownership structure of the zone. This is a refined version of what we originally attached to my earlier evidence, and it's consistent with it, but more accurately defines the homestead pay component. That's the variation. And in summary, we support the provisions of the proposed plan. We support increased density in the Henley Downs area. We, in consultation with the existing community at Jack's Point, had some difficulty arriving at exactly what the numbers of density were because of the range that was used to define density, and it is only in respect of that we offer assistance by way of suggestion. We support what's occurring there, but it may have given rise to some confusion as to possible outcomes, and we're very happy to assist with hearing and council ensuring that some of those concerns that have been raised are not material by more correctly arriving at what is the result of a residential environment that would occur on a basis where all parties have agreed to support each other in the zone, so we are reliant upon council to deliver what everyone is intending, that form the basis of their understanding and support. So it's a matter of clarification where I refer to density and ultimate numbers. Thank you, and welcome questions. This is a very brief summary of what is being pardon me, you that I'm an admiral for several many decades. Yes, we support the idea that the village progress by way of what we used to recall as an outline development plan, but we need to stop using that description as a result of the Environment Court decision on Franklin Flats. But the comprehensive development plan we see replacing this is of equal importance to how we best organise and achieve what was always intended for an integrated village. The outline development plan, which we have yet to share, I guess, so that will be something that
is anything in there that you particularly like to point us to?
Yes, I think the organisation of spatial layout and how it requires this to be addressed in detail and submitted as part of a consent which deals
with the page that we're talking about.
Sorry. Yes, if we refer to the schematics diagrams, perhaps that's the quickest way, which is page, these aren't numbered. It is the diagram plan protection to the words. So when you have a lot of
I've got two documents.
Two documents, the small ones and big ones, and then the 2008 and 2009 documents. I'll just reference which copies I have. If we go to, where is 2009 here? 2009 one is a summary document, which is an update. I think it would be wise to go back to the accounting document, which is 2008, dated 25 July. And if we press just do a quick page turn, I'll take you to the matters that we were required to have regard to, and these are set out firstly as principles referencing the requirements that we had to have regard to in the district plan, and most importantly one that I was wanting to get to was the organisation, spatial layer of built and open space, which skips through all the various elements of the village. I think I'll get a page number for you for reference. In the appendix, yes, it starts really with appendix 5, which sorry is not page numbered, but it is towards the back of the report, of the original report. And the first plan is an illustrative phase one, but more importantly was the following page, there's a series of diagrams and in effect what I could give context around is what I call the wider canvas that we are seeking. And I'll leave legal counsel to address both. But in terms of merit or our view on this is that I will have to go back some time, so many years ago perhaps now, 8 or 9, council approached us about would we be able to accommodate a film studio somewhere out at Jack's Point. And we thought about it and said, well, possibly, but it's a large structure and one that we were uncertain would be an appropriate building scale to fit within a pedestrian village of the nature we were proposing. There was also an approach from a international group, a not-for-profit organisation called the United World College, to secure a site on the edge of the community but accessing trails of nature in the Queenstown area. We agreed after some time to donate 20 hectares of land for that purpose, which was not far from what we now refer to as the EIC, the Education and Innovation Campus Area. That school proposal never proceeded, but there was a desire to provide still for some form of film studio centre that has not materialised, that was later replaced with an innovation canvas from a series of technology companies looking to establish at the Jack's Point site within it somewhere. And so when the proposed plan was being reviewed, we identified historically what an area had always had an asterisk on it for the potential to accommodate some of these new and very much not normal use, but uses that, like film studio or an innovation campus, that occasionally we get approached to see whether it's a fit. And that we agree and support the view that that would be better integrated into a village. The film studio buildings are no longer a relevant consideration. The awkwardness of those was their scale and size, but very large structures. But the innovation and interest in a living, working environment for technology and other new uses was very relevant, and schooling and education facilities. So we agreed that that would be better integrated into the central village. And that gave rise to initially the thought of extended activity area, which was referred to as activity area T. And that coincided with the government approaching us to see whether we could accommodate a public-private partnership hospital in the Jack's Point village. And again, the scale and form of it, we felt would be able to be managed successfully. An additional land area would be required to devote to these new uses not anticipated. So that's both the innovation campus and hospitals and schooling needs. That gave rise to a consolidation of one area which is currently being considered here. Of the adjoining area next to the village. And what it allows us to do is it gives us a bigger campus to work with, whereby we can devote areas to open space and also water space, which is an important element of the village already, where we have a recreational lake, and we were looking to expand and extend that and bring linkages. So having a wider canvas to work with was not any attempt to increase the development entitlement that would otherwise have risen under the site coverage rules of the original activity area, but to assemble a range of uses in a way that is still an integrated living pedestrian village, but one that also enjoys recreational assets like expanded lakes, open waterways and green linkages, and including playing field and school. So these are spatially intensive activities, and we very much support and wish to see those integrated into the village, not separate to stand alone. For example, the junior school we're talking about would be better located in the heart of the village, very close to some of the high density residential houses, rather than outlying in another area. But a larger school with playing field might be better located on the perimeter. So having the wider canvas also allowed us to accommodate these new opportunities for employment, for local living, for schooling, not to generate traffic outside the immediate community, and employment particularly where places of work can be within the pedestrian cycle linkage. And the only way we felt this could be appropriately addressed was to reintroduce the outline development plan process, albeit called a comprehensive development plan, to have regard to many matters that need to be successfully resolved to deliver the very best outcome of one central village.
and we felt it may be of assistance to the hearing panel to bring along what was a past process which we see being repeated, but to taking account of the new opportunities of achieving a very successful village. And the history of the zone is such that in my earlier evidence I referred to, we had two villages side by side as a result of a submission from an adjoining owner. We would like what you received under the plan change. That resulted in a village activity area adjoining the Jacks Point One. The accord we have reached with our neighbouring landowner is we would continue to develop the village, which has been a long-term objective, a key element of the zone, and they prefer to pursue residential with some greater densities than we first thought, and we support that as a rationalisation of activity. So for that reason, we are very clear and desirous, I guess, of the need not to allow a village by default growing into the residential areas and therefore removing the vibrancy and success of this one central village, but also avoiding the adverse effects that visitor accommodation generates and displaces residential living in many neighbourhoods in Queenstown. This is a very, very real issue for our residential areas surrounding the CBD, where they are residential but are in effect hotel rooms, with the consequence effects of parking, displacement of local living, and even affordable rental accommodation for the workforce of Queenstown. So very much a day one principle of Jack's Point has been the village will accommodate the commercial activities, the integration of a lot of mixed uses, and the residential neighbourhoods will be preserved for living. And hearing through the density, I believe is a positive improvement for the zone to allow for higher density, which generates a diversity of residential product. However, where that density becomes greatly in excess of what we're considering in the village, and visitor accommodation is not a difficult test under restricted discretionary, we would not want to see it default like many areas around Queenstown into, in effect, predominantly visitor living or accommodations. So the idea, the among landowners and with the society and the residents who very much are taking ownership of the community, which is desirable and heartwarming to me, was yes, we can get a consolidated one village, we can diversify to include a range of residential living products, and we will not unnecessarily interfere with each other's plans. We don't want to repeat the horrors of Franklin Flats, 5 Mile or Marcus Park. This is a critical element for servicing the needs of the district, that we have residential land freely able to be supplied as the market as demand requires, and that we evolve a true community which focuses around one single village. So the expansion of what the village activity area achieves is an improved spatial location of activities in one central area. The EIC driver being large buildings is no longer a consideration. The schooling and education is very much an immediate requirement, and that is spatially low intensity, but we see desirable if they're centrally located within the pedestrian cycleway networks that focus back out of the village. So when we talk about an increase from 18, we submitted on the E area, which added, I think, 3 hectares of five, I should know that, I think is by expanding it out to what now with the 8 plus the 18, the 3-6 we see today, was to allow us to organise schooling, playing fields, hospital, innovation, but not in a way that was separated on one side of the street or a line, but if you like, could integrate with each other. Primary or the junior school could well be located here in the village activity space we historically had, and vice versa. So it was a widened campus that could then address by this process. This is quite a lot of ideas, I'm afraid, and I just handed it to you. So, but it addresses many of the matters that ordinarily was come straight to mind as well. How do you achieve this integration? One central hub is important, I believe it is. How then do you achieve it, organise it, deal with the many, many issues to arrive at a great central hub of the community? Well, the comprehensive development plan addresses that, in my opinion, very well. And there's another version of this. We don't oppose the, what I call the loosening or enabling provisions this review has proposed for residential, because the delivery of residential plans should be a matter that could be managed without discretionary or further consenting if the structure plan adequately addresses the diversity of residential products, location, and good site standards and performances. The village, however, is a more complex animal, and that's why we're very happy to propose a status be upgraded from what was delivered to control. And the control matters reflect the outline development plan process, which we've already in 2008 initiated. We reacquired the village some time back, and now ready to develop it. We have hotels planned immediately, well advanced, and we have just secured the first gigahertz connection for a community in New Zealand for us to support the innovation, seeing an innovation hub from a software group. So these things have been a long time in the maturation and now coming together, and for that, unusually, I guess, we're looking for a high degree of control on ourselves, because to try to deal with these matters in a district plan, set of diagrams or some special zone is highly complex, and I believe this process very well provides all the matters that would be of concern both to the residents in the area and the wider community objects at Queenstown. So there's a lot of paper there. These revisions, I'm afraid, that are summary revisions that accept the foundation work here on all the various design guidelines and how we organize streetscape, build an open space networks. And we're keen to also expand the lake, which is giving up what would otherwise be expensive real estate available for commercial activity. But we believe imbalance creates the right outcome. So blue networks, green networks, and you will see from the original plan how we've addressed spatial organisation, use transportation, pedestrianisation, and built form streetscapes. And the comprehensive development plan will expand that to the wider activity area and incorporate those important new activities, education, innovation, healthcare, and even the retirement living. So mixed-use buildings, we believe, are important where you can have affordable residential living on the upper level of retail, you could have a retirement village that's integrated into the fabric of the village, as opposed behind some landscape gates out in the countryside. And that vibrancy supports the community and connects with the community. Childcare, and these are pedestrian networks that service the village, support certain uses more appropriately than the residential neighbourhoods, and that is why we have differentiation of activity for residential and village. So hopefully that helps explain why it's a very good subject. And I'm not used to this having to give a summary of it.
And I think you touched on it in the presentation, is the extension of the village area to the south, what's called Area E.
Yes.
And we were basically querying why it would be desirable to allow, among a range of uses, just general retail commercial development in that area. You've got obviously a very well thought through plan, just like where you showed us. The evidence we've heard so far is that the likely retail demand for what might be 8,000 people living out here ultimately is something like in the region of about 2 hectares, including parking. So even that was the heat evidence. So even if he was wrong by a factor of 2 or 3, we've got an enormous capacity here to accommodate retail commercial development. You just wondered why it would be appropriate to provide for it over here in this E area. That would seem to me to be dissipating the model you've just explained to us.
Yes, we would, in the comprehensive development plan, specify use. All that we were pointing out is to have an artificial line separating certain activities from other activities. Retail is consolidated into one area, and we are agreeable, and you'll hear evidence from Brett Thompson, that we agree there should be some form of measure of cap or dedication of retail. As to its location, it is, we have a main street which is to the south side, and our new plans, which we are not sharing for no reason, and we would only further, I think, burden this hearing, because it is a matter of addressing the comprehensive development plan. But that is centralised. But some activities that are occurring in the existing village area may be displaced by, for example, school, that would then be replaced in the other area. So it allows us one campus to get the very best outcome, as opposed to one area dedicated to certain activities, another to another set of activities. The degree of interaction or interplay between those diagrams of the activity area are critical, as opposed to line. We don't see retail being expanded or necessarily going to the south, to answer a specific question on that. But we do like the idea of the junior school being in the right area with playing fields, because those playing fields generate green space in the centre of what otherwise would be some high density residential living or mixed-use buildings. So you get a more efficient outcome of balance of building open space. Certain healthcare facilities may be consolidated. A hospital would be on the peripheral in the way we are already looking at our land use planning. But the school with playing fields and central green space, there's a positive element to experience within a pedestrian village. And we are also looking to expand some lakes to provide a continuity of linkage between the two areas, and felt it was difficult to specify activity than one versus the other, that that was a manifest interest in the comprehensive development plan. And as I noted, we're not seeking to expand the development footprint, but just better organise it with the new campus, which we think is a good outcome from the relocation of the EIC, the removal of the village activity and handling, all being accommodated in one central area. So the Henley village had an activity area of 13.5 hectares that is now gone. EIC was an area of about approximately 12 hectares that's gone. So by expanding from 18 to 36, we know we can fit them all in and integrate them, but we do submit respectfully that the comprehensive development plan is the right process to result in the very best of open space, built space, and activity, land use, or type of use. So yes, we accept that we will be seeking to grow a lot of retail in this area, but there will be some swaths between the two. I'm sure that will deliver a better outcome for all.
My other question was, make sure I'm understanding it correctly, in terms of the approach that RTL have taken to this process, both the city liberalised rules framework, is it fair to say that your concern is not that more intensive development would necessarily be inappropriate, but it needs to go through a screening and planning process first before, rather than, as RCL has suggested, by having very, very liberal guesses, and that board is your concern?
Yes, but we support the what we call the densification, I suppose, and it's significant in terms of growth in numbers, because we do need residential capacity in Queenstown. Jeff's point was always happy to have a merit-based consenting path where you address issues that may be of concern and formally go through a controlled activity or some other path. We also have private agreements with landowners whereby they agreed to submit their designs and we ran a design review board process. I personally believe the best people to ultimately be the stewards of the community are the community itself, and this was a way of transitioning the ownership of what would be the outcomes of the community, which is the Residents Association. And it worked in partnership with council. It was clear there was a duplication of process where the design review board and the association would review matters and approve or assist coerce, and we have guidelines, etc. So yes, it was absolutely logical that when we looked at the duality of process, having gone through that council resource consent, council and processing those were very reliant on the fact that it had already had quite a lot of scrutiny at the final review boards. So that gave rise to a view, well, do we need this duality? And as the council should have regard to, would he retain. The permitted status, though, does require some other form of, if you like, understanding and agreement that initially the developer handing over to the community, sooner the better often, maintain a private arrangement to otherwise deliver what we were achieving at Jack's Point with the design review board process. RCL's view was that they believe product range of residential products would be provided. We support that. Increased number, we support that. And I believe they are proposing design guidelines and a resident society of their own. So we would happily assist. And the template is well established at Jack's Point. We would envisage a similar template being applied to Henley. The one area we had concern around was practicality of some of the other themes of these. I guess a lot of us quickly said, hey, how do you get to those sort of densities? You can in some areas, but there are a lot of matters you must have regard for when you get to those very high densities.
That's like 45 units per hectare.
Yes, yes. And I think there's been some confusion because our role is we're stewards of the original vision that in turn we represent the resident society. In many ways of communicating plans. So when we were communicating 45 per hectare, we had to explain that was on a net density basis, not gross. My preference has been gross, but that's a personal view. Net is up, you take gross and open space away, you then have 45 per hectare of a reduced hectare, which is a reduced number. But it does give rise to some very small lots. We recently, a number of times, have reached out to RCL's planners to assist us understand how it works. And it may be more appropriate, it will be more appropriate to explain it. So you'll see from evidence that we feel that 45 may be excessive. We're not opposed to the idea of that level of density can be achieved successfully, but not on a committed basis, because there are many matters you have to regard for. And as I understand it, RCL area is not on a committed basis at 45 at all, because it would breach the minimum lot size and therefore trigger a restricted discretionary path. So our suggestion, which is one of assistance to progressing this sign, not opposing, was, well, if you are going to trigger restricted discretionary above or boundaries, I believe that Mr. Ferguson and his evidence, well, it was just the detail, a figure of around 24 or 25 for triggers by minimum lot size, a non-permitted but restricted discretionary. And the matters to have regard for in restricted discretionary are adequacy of green space, roving, network, parking, the efficiency of the organisation of the neighbourhood or the development. And we're very comfortable with that. But it did give rise to some confusion and concerns from residents that this is wildly different from the original 12 per hectare design was founded on. We support diversification of products and smaller lots, etc. We like the increasing range that will be provided in the proposed plan. But I think people didn't understand that 45 would be already a matter of restricted discretion, and the matters to have regard for were matters that would otherwise be of concern. And Mr. Coburn, who's the chairman of the Resident Owners Association at Jack's Point, whose job it was to listen and address these matters, will discuss how he believes they've been met through some very minor refinements to the proposed or the provisions of the design. And it's not one of, I believe, great difficulty to have a result. It's difficult to be committed above item 24, and I mentioned that in my evidence. We're not opposed to above 24, we're just saying, well, given the developers come and go, owners come and go, how do you ensure those matters will continue to be addressed? You need good criteria and restricted discretionary provisions. In other words, the matters must cover. And one of the matters of concern was we have a wonderful recreational lake, the kiddies swimming and trousing around it, and we've got a great lens to protect the water quality. It would be unfortunate if the stormwater intensification and urban runoff were to contaminate either the wetland waters or the lake field water. We now ask you, I'm not proposing or wishing to see that happen. So logically, there's the matters that restrict discretion and address. So by way of assistance, we make those comments to better inform others and others who are opposing the zone, because it's often as a result of misunderstanding the ultimate intentions that could generate a residential number well in excess of what we believe our development intending or council are understanding of. So I hope you will see Mr. Ferguson on detail around the high density 45.
I have no questions. Thank you, Mr. Darby.
Thank you.
Very important.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next witness is Mr. Conrad.
My name is Michael Coburn. I'm the committee chairman of the Jack Point Residents and Homeowners Association, the third group of the JPRIA, and I'm representing the prevention field in that capacity. My statement of evidence dated 3rd February covers the detail of the following matters. A, an overview of the JPRIA role, structure, and general workings, including the design of the usual process. B, opposition to the prevailing proposal for the OECR land, the current open space land. C, the improvements to the combined capital relief presented by the Jackson developer for the hearing, including Tomsite consolidation of the village. E, previous EIC activities. The most efficient and appropriate use of the table land / village slopes areas and other. I wish to emphasise my original evidence, which confirms that as part of the JPR role, which considered appropriate that JPR undertake consultation with as many residents as well as possible on the DPR. JPR considered support to understand these concerns and better see if they could be addressed. JPRIA's mission for DPR promoted a general support of JPR's vision for the earthquake, given the extensive consultation and involvement the site and the Jackson developer had in leading up to that verification. In this respect, I wish to clarify that the JPRIA's mission was not determined by the control member, as suggested in the evidence of Mr. Rabbit, paragraph 22, dated 8th February 2017. It was approved at committee level. Committee members who all approved the submission were democratically elected at the annual general meeting of the society. The submission is entirely within the JPRIA's mandate as it was made in compliance with the Constitution. Also, we should clarify a number of matters raised in Mr. Bradford's evidence in respect to the JPRIA constitutional role, its procedure and purpose as follows. The Chair does not have an overriding vote. The Chair has a casting vote, exercised only in the case of a 5 in the vote at committee level, reference there to clause 12, top 11, constitution. The controlling member does have an overriding vote, but there is a process which must be followed, which makes the decision making transparent and gives the members the opportunity to make submissions. The principle 15.7 of the constitution requires that. Controlling member must give 14 days notice to relevant members, depending on the matter on hand. The notice will outline that matter at issue together with the places of detention and that controlling member has to vote in the past. Members have the right to provide written submission to controlling member on the matter at issue. The controlling member will in good faith consider the submission via request for an exercise. So, the constitution is clear, it has been the initial corporation society on the roles of committee, developers and controlling members. These entities and governance bodies are given the power to further develop the Jack's Point and the representative JROA. To say there is a conflict of interest is not correct. The whole basis of the JROA and the development is that the developer controls JTROA is the controlling member, and the controlling member appoints the chair of the society. The fact that the society is aligned with the developer via the controlling member chair mechanism in the constitution is what the structure was anticipated from the beginning. This is key to it, so regards to the RMA matters reinforced by subsequent technology covenants. In response to the evidence of Mr. Wells for RCL, note that paragraph 104, he states that RCL has agreements in place which allow easements and infrastructure over the RCL proposed OSCR. I confirm that there are no such agreements, and if there were, the JPRA would expect to be heavily involved in such negotiations and would not support it. I support the commitment to reserving, we support the commitment to reserving a minimum of 2 hectares within the expanded village or school to service the needs of the community. As stated in my evidence, there is a clear need for an education zone plan. An expanded village area is an ideal location within the community hub to set this land aside. I also support the removal of the Stir land from the RSPG activity area. This land was possibly sold by the JPROA, the basis of the remaining open space.
Yes, just on this issue of the wastewater discharge fields. Does the Residents Association hold the consents for the discharge?
Yes, we have an easement over there, and
but
it holds the consents for the
control. You can have the consents from the regional council for that.
And a multiple of regions,
yeah. The other question, just from your evidence on page 11, set up there, the Residents Association concerned with the density of the development in the Hanley Farm area.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, what is the distinction the Residents Association draws between the density in that area and the potential density of residential development sought by Jack's Point in the village and in the V and the E area?
The JPROA probably looks for more clarity around what the density is proposed. We have seen draft concept plan which illustrated some 1,350 lots, which I can understand was a result of what was originally anticipate that concerns the residents with blocks, which is 5 to 6 years. And balance being a change of restriction of what the village land is changing from village zone to residential zone. Hence, increased total, we understand that. We subsequently are aware that that increase from 30 to 50 to 70 to 50, that plan, or concept plan, we have not had the opportunity to do. And it's really this understanding, well, this plan is in the enabler.
Well, just one final point of clarification on the very last point, 7, which I think is going to come up in the evidence for RPL. You're talking here about that 0.8 hectare triangle,
okay.
Which is seeking to have changed to basically HDB, so you're saying you're opposed to that.
Just wondering if you can recall, you clarified with the submission that it was said what was the controlling member of the committee decision. I wonder if you can recall that you can recall if that's an outreach decision or the dissenting voice in the committee meeting.
It's just one point that didn't pick up on, which is just fine detail on that third end, the RHDC boundary adjustment, that looking at the issue of scope, that derived from a lot of the residents who sought revision to the opposite district plan position, and that their activity area boundaries as proposed now is more consistent with the opposite activity area boundaries than what was proposed by. So the next witness is Mr. Brett Thompson.
Thank you. Introduction, my name is Richard Brett Thompson. My experience and qualifications are spread out in my evidence stated at the Executive Queen's Group in Village and Comprehensive Development Plan. The design, planning and economic development of Greenfield Village, as opposed to a big hostel, bog retail precinct, a remarkable park, are a complex process requiring adaptability and flexibility in how the land developer undertakes the process of background circumstances by the GFC in 2009, or other opportunities, by the SPAN, for example, education. It is my experience that this mechanism for adaptability and flexibility of design outcome can produce one for the Jack's Point residential areas and one for the Jack's Point village. It's a production of a comprehensive development plan, CDP, that acts as an intermediary step between the structure plan and the subdivision plan. It allows us, during the 2008 village ODP, to simultaneously work up both the big picture village framework, as well as the fine grained detail of the village as we workshop with urban designers, architects, council staff, consultants, eventually culminating and presenting to the GRDC Urban Design Panel. We're constantly zooming in and out of the village during the process to assess both the village plan and building designs. It is simply impossible to write the design and site standards and undertake a significant and master plan in the new village. It will become a sizable volume of plan restrictions written to avoid poor design outcome rather than encourage positive outcome. A CDP, grounded in solid urban design principles and community building, backed up by solid district plan policy framework, is my preferred mechanism that is focused on positive design outcome. And the process should, in my opinion, be retained within the district plan provisions of the Jack's Point Village. Village education. The removal of the EIC, 30.24 hectare activity area to the north of Jack's Point, and the inclusion of the E area, 5.1 hectares, adjoining the village is a logical and vastly improved outcome from the landscape and market planning perspective. It's existing my evidence that consolidation of activity areas might be reviewed in terms of the land area required. My desktop exercise suggested that another 3 hectares could easily be added to the E area to make a total of 8.1 hectares without any material adverse effects over and above that proposed within the 5 hectare activity area. I know that combining the JPV and the E area as a combined JPV makes sense as integration of activities is important as it is as compared to the segregation of activities by an artificial hard activity area boundary, which serves little purpose in my opinion. I understand that Mr. Jones' views would keep the activity areas of B and E separate and E at 45% site coverage, possibly as a mechanism to ensure that an E area is used for education purposes. I understand that the submitters now support an amendment to the Comprehensive Development Plan rule to include a matter of control where the CDP may provision a minimum of 2 hectares of land for a school to serve the needs of the community. So lay those concerns expressed by Mr. Jones. I also recommend that the site coverage remain at 60% of the JDB. Once again, the CDP process will enable further design and planning to investigate and test potential outcomes. The matter of a 300 square metre maximum GFA for commercial uses and the logical increase from 200 square metres that would capture the opportunity for some of the corner store to be considered as controlled activity. For example, the 4 square in our town has an approximate GFA of 240 square metres, so the proposed upper maximum appears adequate. Activities in the RHDP area, this is a combination of residential activities. The concern I have here is the dilution of the DA activities spreading away from the village as a residential neighbourhood. As the principle of urban design, articulated in the well-known book, A Hidden Language, by Christopher Alexander et al., has studied the pedestrian behaviour make it clear that people seek out concentrations of other people to create their concentration in the community that facilities must be grouped densely, which function the most. The reference to community facilities applies equally to any facility, with the emphasis being on pedestrian. The Jack's Point Village is highly focused on being walkable, primarily to enable the above urban condition to be established. I'm unsure how you achieve this outcome in a residential context, but the provision that allows, according to Mr. Wells, approximately 1,750 dwellings, spread well over 100 hectares, to provide for visitor accommodation. whilst I accept that VA's discretion in our areas, it is restricted discretion in residential area E. And whilst nobody, not everybody will take up such an opportunity, particularly given the housing densities, planning is based on the worst case scenario. And the effect of that provision seems not only detrimental to the premise of the residential activity, but also seems detrimental to creating a dense, compact and vibrant village.
A couple of things, just in paragraph 11. I'm just wondering if Rosie did confirm.
Sorry?
I'm just wondering if Rosie did confirm.
Well, there is a... I was going to
bring the... And what was confirming?
The correction to the reference to 300 square. We are imposing that for retail uses, not commercial as well.
Right.
So that's just
a
question of
who's in the position. Right.
You
can cross that out, please. Yeah. In terms of the comprehensive development plan, I understand entirely what you're saying, and I just want to take you through scenarios that, as I see it, may occur under the provisions as Ferguson was like this. But as I understand it, at the moment, Jackson Group is not the best in overall village lands and would use a comprehensive development plan, and that would get consent for something and commence the process of the village. At some stage, presumably, some of that land will be sold because that point group won't be the ultimate owner of eventually every piece of land in the place. The way the rules are drafted, a subsequent owner can come up with an application to something of any nature, and the council would have to grant consent for that. That's a comprehensive development plan attached to it. Is that what you envisage?
My understanding is that the land that the parts are sold and other development, they have to make sure they comply with the comprehensive development plan. If it's contrary to the comprehensive development plan, it becomes a discretionary activity.
But the rules have drafted says that the application can attach a new comprehensive development plan so that the new developer could draft a different comprehensive development plan to incorporate the aspects on the other end that Jack's would have done, but be something totally different on their land, which may not be within the original vision. Is that what is anticipated?
I think that's what's anticipated. I imagine that sort of transaction would be quite an agreement in itself, just as to what would be the outcomes of that.
I'm just thinking about, I don't know if it's been considered that private agreement, it's actually considered that what the rules provide for. Should the rules certainly be provided for that outcome? Or should, and I understand them entirely the proposal, because I've dealt with these situations before, and the sort of unlogical way from this. And we still political government. But I'm just wondering whether the control acts of these steps is appropriate, given that there may be situations where subsequent owners do something that the council may want to do in Singapore, but the drafting of the rules says they can't. Is that what the rule of opinion be on that?
Well, I don't think that's anticipated outcome, but I can see it soon. That's the position. I'm not exactly sure if the developer attaches these easements as a separate outline of the development plan for their particular parcel of land.
Well, no, they can do the whole lot. They can copy the piece that everyone else is piece of land, but change theirs, and then still comply with the rules because they're comprehensive to the development plan.
Yeah, I can see you can see. Possibly a bit more reviews to take to how they can move forward.
We'll make sure that Mr. Ferguson can think about that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Mr. Ferguson has a penchant for everything being controlled, and I've been through this with him already in the proposition hearing. But there are situations where the council may need to refuse consent terms, and I think we need to kind of throw up rules for that possibility, not as a hindrance to things, but only possible, because the world is not a perfect place.
So you're, so that we're clear on what we're trying to figure out, is your primary concern how to control subsequent variations of the CDT for the full activity area?
My concern is that we cannot presume that every comprehensive development plan will be acceptable. That's my primary concern. There must be the opportunity to say no, that's not appropriate. And it goes to the matter of discretion, obviously. But I think that needs to be seriously thought about.
One of the mechanisms, when we did the original one, we had to proceed to the QIC design councils. Essentially workshop with them, they had recommendations and suggestions and she was improved from the handling of the layout. So that gave the flexibility to dialogue with council.
Although the design panel was not a statutory mechanism outside of this process. And the council decision makers seem to not obliged to follow those reports or from the design panel. That is information, not literature. I don't think that helps us. In the scenarios that I'm suggesting. And I'm happy to discuss that and what you deal with when it comes to.
It's helpful to telegraph those interests and that, and then I can start thinking about this. But for me, it really helps to understand the nature of what they're concerned in terms of whether that relates to the cost of design. Or is it the concern relating to the spatial planning outcomes? Just that sort of probably answers the question that goes to the scope of the complement of the community itself. Whether it's organising buildings and spatial layouts of those activities in a sort of a spatial sense, or is it actually something more fundamental around the actual nature of the activity as compared to the effects of it in other respects of it? To me,
the comprehensive development plan is a means get a good outcome. And it is attached to an activity because the only way we can do that is through the act. That's why it happens to an activity. I think that we all understand that. And it's still Parliament realises there may be other ways of doing it, but we can't get around that. The issue I'm concerned about is that the process can be deviated by the simple act of wanting a new comprehensive development plan, which might undermine some of the original features that cannot be refused consent. That's the ability to refuse consent, which I think is important. It may not happen, but I think that we could happen quite readily.
We've got a multiple open situations that we have certain issues that might come off.
As I agreed the rule, any subsequent development could come in with a new CDP. CDP covered the entire zone because they have to apply for the entire zone to reorient it.
Yes,
that's
right.
Yeah, and that's
right.
Well, I think, yes, I think that's the problem with mine. And there's no rights for the other people to be involved either, because there's no problem. There's no notification, there's no third party rights. We don't have any other systems possible, so and it's pretty convenient for a couple of minutes at once, so we'll be doing sort of stuff.
So, thank you.